Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Colin Mustful, your host today, and I'm delighted to be joined by Jay Wiener, co-author of the book, Professor Berman, The Last Lecture of Minnesota's Greatest Public Historian. Jay, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jay Wiener spent most of his career as a Twin Cities-based journalist, first at the Star Tribune and later at MinnPost, covering sports business issues, the Olympics, and eventually Minnesota politics. He went on to become the speechwriter for former University of Minnesota President Eric Kaler and now works as a communications manager for the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis. He is the author of Stadium Games, 50 Years of Big League Greed and Bush League Boondoggles, and This Is Not Florida, How Al Franken Won the Minnesota Senate Recount, which was nominated for a 2011 Minnesota Book Award. Jay, I guess to start off, I wonder if you could classify for listeners if you're the author, the co-author. You know, at reading this, it's written in the first person through Professor Berman's words. So how would you classify your participation in it?
Well, I was the writer of the book, and I'll tell you why, and I can explain how the book happened, and that would further explain how it was written. I didn't know High all that well as a reporter. And as you said, I was a reporter at the Minneapolis Star Tribune and at MinnPost, the website, for about 30 years. During the course of my career, I knew of High and he knew of me, mostly because we might appear on a Twin Cities public television show called Almanac once in a while. But I never quoted him really in a story. And then about 10 years ago, a pharmacist here in the Twin Cities, a progressive guy who was always talking about single-payer health care and free college education before it was a popular topic. He and High and a sculptor here in town named Doug Freeman had an idea to build a monument or a gathering place, a park, to what they called the common man, to celebrate the working class. And periodically, they would go out to dinner and invite guests to brainstorm about what this project, this center, this place would be. And because I went to this pharmacist, and High went to this pharmacist, Thomson Gupta, the pharmacist, invited me to go to one of these dinners. And before long, I was going out maybe 4 to 6 times a year with High and Thomson Gupta and Doug Freeman, the sculptor. And High would tell stories every time we went out to dinner. We drank martinis and we ate Italian food. And they would be the same stories all the time. And the way I describe it would be like going to a Bruce Springsteen concert. You know what songs are coming, but you still want to be there and dance to them. So on his 90th birthday, High invited me to come to it. And he was sitting there in this noisy room. And I walked over to him and I said, "Hi, you know, has anybody ever recorded any of your stories at all?" I had no ulterior motive. I had no idea I would write this book with him. And he said, "No, nobody cares about my stories." And I said, "Well, let me come by your house one day soon, and I'll get down some of your stories about former Governor Rudy Perfecture in Minnesota, about Hubert Humphrey, the former presidential candidate, about Paul Wellstone, the senator who was killed in a plane crash. And I said, fine. So a couple months later, actually, there was no urgency to it. I wandered over to his house. And lo and behold, he handed over to me a three-ring binder, a blue binder. And in it were, in fact, interviews he had done with a political scientist from Long Beach State in California named Jack Stewart. They were heavily about his political life, early political life, affiliated with the Communist Party. And he explained to me that he and Jack Stewart could never get the book together. Jack was an older man himself. They both had strong personalities. And he looked me in the eye and he said, what do you think? Can you help me? So I kind of hypnotized me. I don't know if you've ever been hypnotized by a kind of acute 90-year-old roly-poly guy. And I agreed to help him with this book. And that would have been the spring of 2015. We put together an outline. We filed for his Freedom of Information Act files from the FBI. We talked about what the book might look like, that it would be in first person. It would be his last lecture, which he was famous for giving good ones at the University of Minnesota, where he was a professor for 40 years. And we pretty much hashed out chapter one. Then Hai got sick and he died. And he died in November of 2015, so about 5 or 6 months after we started to work on this. During the course of the interviews that I had with Hai, and really I spent maybe 20 to 30 hours with him. He told me that he was a super disorganized person, and that is true, he was, and that he never really kept anything. No records, didn't keep much of his PhD work that he did at Columbia in the 1950s. And when I went to the University of Minnesota archives, for instance, there were just a bunch of 3x5 cards, 4x6 cards, and a lot of files, not many files, but some files that mostly said, "Gol darn it, Berman, where's that chapter you promised us 2 years ago?" Because I never really wrote that much and didn't get to deadlines much. And then when he died and the family began to clean out the house, they found 22 boxes of things of mine. So there I was with the old Jack Stewart interviews, the interviews I had done with Hai, the reviews of all of his TV appearances with him, and now 22 boxes of stuff. So that took me about a year to go through all of those because I had a job at the time. And so when you ask, was I the co-author? Well, yes, it's Hai's voice, it's Hai's words, it's words he said in interviews with me, with Jack Stewart, on television, on radio. Some of the book is material that he wrote that I put further into what I tried to think was his voice. So I would say 90 to 95% of these words are his, but I organized it. It is Hai's book. I like to say that it would be, if you can put the book up to your ear, I hope that you can hear Hai's voice. And so that's my answer to your question.
Wow. Well, I definitely think you accomplished that. You can. There's a distinct voice throughout the book, and I think that's probably Hai's. So it was really quite a long process then, wasn't it?
It was, because, again, we start, you know, somewhat casually in the spring of 2015, thinking that he would be alive to help me write the book, and also, you know, that he would be approving it all. Then he dies in that latter part of 2015. The family clears out the house in 2016. I get those documents late in 2016. It takes me, you know, about a year, 10 to 12 months till the end of 2017 to get it all done. And then during the course of 2018, the book is edited in the University of Minnesota Press, which does a great job. You know, had some other books on their spring calendar that year, so they pushed it to the fall. And finally, the book came out last November of 2019.
Well, it must feel pretty good to get that project finally out there.
It did. You know what's sort of interesting, and maybe people who are listening who have written books of their own can relate to this. As you mentioned, I've written two other books. One about one that was a social history of stadiums here in the Twin Cities, and in the 90s and the early 2000s, we were really ground zero for sports finance debates about public financing, but it was a debate that went back into the 1950s. That was based on almost all the reporting that I did for the Star Tribune, where I covered sports finance issues for about 15 years. And my second book about the Al Franken, Norm Coleman recount of 2008 and 2009 was based on reporting I did for MinPost, the website here. And those books were truly mine. I mean, I felt great ownership with those. This book, I wanted to make sure it was Hy's. It was not only for all of the students that he had taught over his 40 years, which are thousands, it was for his family. And so in some ways, yes, it felt great to get it done. I felt a sense of accomplishment, as all people do who write books. But I wanted to make sure that this was Hy's book also. So there's a little bit of a distance of connection to it to a certain extent, because every time I sat down to write and put it together, I was trying to think, how would Hy say this, and would Hy be happy with it? So it was a great feeling of accomplishment, just a little bit different feeling.
So I'm curious, what was the response of Hy's family?
They were pretty happy. So he's got a daughter and a son, and his wife is still alive. Her health has not been been great recently. Her name is Betty. But to go back, the night of Hy's funeral, Betty came up to me in his house where people had gathered, and she was already beginning to lose her memory a bit, but she knew who I was. But she found me amidst all these people who were there and kind of wagged her finger at me and said, You're gonna finish that book, aren't you?" And I said to myself, "Geez, now I really do have to finish it." That was November of 2015. I heard from Ruth, his daughter, who is actually an editor in California, and she made my day, my week, my month when she read the advance. We did, as a courtesy, send them the advance copy of the book. They did not have any rights to edit anything at all. We did ask if they saw any mistakes at all. But she said it felt like she was sitting in the living room of their house with her father. So I felt, you know, quite good about that I had succeeded in providing the voice of people who knew him. And that's all that I heard. I got a thank you from his son. But I really haven't heard that much from them, other than I know that they were fine with it. And one of the guidelines, and Hy didn't have many guidelines about the book, was not to write about his family, that it was supposed to be a political, you know, it's not a biography, an autobiography, but mostly about his life in politics and in higher ed. In the final chapter, I do write a little bit about his family, because I learned about it mostly after his death. He did have another daughter who had died, and he did talk briefly about that. So in general, the family was happy with it. When I first got my first copy of the book, I went to see Betty in her care center, and she was quite happy to hold the book. So again, even if you don't sell a million books like Michelle Obama or Stephen King or something like that, there is some satisfaction when you know that people care about what's written.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. And I can say that it's definitely sounds like an autobiography written by Hy Berman. So even though I did not know him, I'm going to ask you quite a challenging question. So Hy Berman lived for over 90 years, and he had quite a few experiences with the politics, social climate of the time. I'm wondering if you can just put his life within its historical context.
Well, Hy's life was a series of transitions. And so to put it in historical context is to put it into a collection of context, if I can. One is his early years, which is the context of a immigrant communist Jewish milieu of New York in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And he was the son of Polish immigrants, the son of union activists. His father was so active and so progressive and left-wing in the Amalgamating Clothing Workers Union that he was kicked out of the union. He claimed, and his mother claimed, that she was more progressive than her husband, which suggested that she would have been kicked out of the union also. But this was a period of time in New York in that, you know, early to moving up into the war years of a very progressive left-wing Jewish academic education-focused community that was affiliated in many ways from his childhood on through his teenage years and then his early years of college with the Communist Party. So that's the first historic context there. Certainly anti-fascist to the extent that, you know, I was in the army and he didn't fight in the war, but was drafted. And so there was that. Then in the 1950s, as he got out of the army and got his PhD and began to teach, he was in that period of time historically where there was realization that the Soviet Union was not the nirvana that he and other young activists thought that it was in those early years, the 20s and the 30s. I became a devoted FDR New Dealer. By now it's the 50s and that's over, but he became a Democrat as opposed to a seemingly member of the Communist Party, although he claims that he was not a member of the party and there's no indication in his FBI files that he was. He was certainly affiliated with it. So in that context, when others on the left were beginning to become disillusioned with the Communist Party, I was too. And then he moved here. I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he moved to the University of Minnesota. And the historic context there was the Democratic split around the 1960s of the anti-Vietnam War Democrats and those who were supportive of the Kennedy-Johnson strategy on Vietnam. I was to the left of that, and this is why early on he didn't support Hubert Humphrey, but rather supported Eugene McCarthy in the 1968 election. And he was also part of, historically in higher education, a period of time of multiculturalism and a big supporter and even an advocate for and a builder here at the University of Minnesota of programs like women's studies, Hispanic studies, African-American studies, et cetera. As time moved on, and now we're getting to another context and transition, and this is a different kind of transition, I was very open and innovative on public history and being accessible to the average person. And so he took great advantage of television and radio. Now, if he were younger, I'm sure he would have had a very active Twitter account. He did have a Facebook page before he died, but didn't have much on there. But unlike many university professors and academics, he was not afraid to be in the public spotlight. And so I think that that's a transition that really did him well and made him known as a public historian here in the Twin Cities. So when you ask about the historic context, I don't know if you meant what I just answered, but to me, those transitions in his life reflect and reinforce some of the trends in the country at that time.
Yeah, you stated that very well. It's just, as I was reading it, it was just remarkable to try and imagine what was life was like during these transitions and everything that he experienced.
You know, he liked, for people who met him, he was at least when I met him, and he was in his 80s by the time I met him, he was a cuddly, avuncular kind of guy who you could imagine at Thanksgiving, pinching your cheek and giving you some advice and telling you stories. If you see videos of him in his prime, which would be in the 80s and 90s, and I have, you really see a man in full, someone who can give a lecture while he's on television, you know, a mini lecture about the importance of higher education, the importance or the meaning of a Minnesota election in 1938 and how anti-Semitism might have driven the Republicans to win that. The point being that as cuddly as he was, he had a pretty good-sized ego, and he wanted to be in the middle of things. This is me now talking about Hayek, not him talking about him. But witness the fact that he was able to affiliate with some pretty big personalities themselves. You know, he became an advisor to Governor Rudy Perpich here in Minnesota, and Perpich had this big, what would you call it? I mean, they called him Governor Goofy. You know, he had these big ideas. Some of them worked, like the Mall of America. Others didn't. He affiliated himself, I did, with Hubert Humphrey after Humphrey's defeat in 68 and became a friend of his. He crossed paths with Paul Wellstone when Wellstone was still a professor at Carleton College here in Minnesota, because Perpich and Wellstone were spatting about an issue here in the state. He was in the middle of helping to hire the first woman Supreme Court Justice here in Minnesota, Rosalie Wall. He liked to be in the middle of things. He liked to be out there. And as humble and cute as he seemed on television and on radio, he was substantially interested in being out in front of people. And it could go back. I think it does go back to this feeling as a young person, and his parents' feeling as a young person as an immigrant, of being the other. And I talked about that a lot, of how immigrants in his time and today never really feel as if they're part of the community and part of the culture. They need to prove themselves. And there's something that I found in one of those 22 boxes that I write about in the last chapter, of a picture of him with Governor Perpich in the 1970s. So High at this point is in his late 50s, maybe early 60s. And it's a note to his mother. So I'm assuming that when his parents died, he cleaned out their house and got their boxes. And it says something like, "Look, Ma, I'm with the governor." So he was even bragging to his mother at age 50 about what he was doing. And maybe we all do that. I'm not sure. But there was a certain sense about High that he wasn't appreciated enough. That's something that I took away from reading his stuff and then talking with him over that short period of time.
Well, just having read your book, I can tell you that I came to appreciate the influence he had on this state and in this country, the things that I didn't know about that he was a part of.
Well, he became, I think today the term might be a thought leader. I don't know if that term is worn out already. I know in the last couple of years, people use the term thought leader, and he was. He was a thought leader by not only teaching literally thousands of students over the course of his 40 years through his appearances on local radio and TV, through his columns that he wrote for the St. Paul Pioneer Press for a number of years, and then through his elbowing in, as it were, to the lives of different influential people. And then his ability, as he was a thought leader, to either get under their skin or to push them along the way. I think of two examples. One was with Perpich, who was his friend and confidant during a pretty infamous Hormel meatpackers strike here in the 1990s. I think my dates are a little bit off. But when Perpich called in the National Guard to stop the strike. High wrote an op-ed in the St. Paul Pioneer Press condemning him, and that really got under the Prippert's skin. Another time that he was influential, and this is with the on the other side of the aisle, was with Harold Stassen, the perennial presidential candidate, who was the governor of Minnesota back in the 1930s and 40s. And High criticized Stassen for his role in that 1938 election when the Republican Party, in High's view, used anti-Semitism in order to beat Elmer Benson. And the two of them, Stassen and Berman, went on to become friends because High wrote an article in 1976 condemning Stassen for not speaking out enough against the anti-Semitism of the Republicans. Stassen called him and complained and said that he had done some work around that. High said that was BS. They became friends. And when Stassen died, before he died, obviously, he asked High to deliver the eulogy at his funeral. So he had influence in that way in speaking, you know, so-called truth to power, and in making it public. And when I spoke a little bit back about him feeling underappreciated, perhaps in academic circles, and I'm guessing that some people who listen to your podcast are in academic circles, High thought, and I believe it's true, that being so public and translating history for the citizenry was looked down upon. That you know, the way to succeed in academia, in his view, and actually in mine, is sometimes to write articles in esoteric journals for 100 people in a language that no one truly understands, other than those, you know, few people who read it. He thought that was a waste of time, and so he also felt that because of his public persona, he was often shunned by some people in the academic world because he wasn't, you know, scholarly enough. He was a great scholar when he did scholarship, but he didn't write or publish as much as some of his colleagues did. And he was more of an activist, not only on campus and helping students and being in faculty governance, but more of an activist in the way that he helped to form opinions, you know, in the Twin Cities and across the state of Minnesota.
You mentioned anti-Semitism, and I was born in 1982. And so for some of our younger listeners, it might come as a surprise, because it did to me, the type of anti-Semitism that Berman faced, especially when he came to Minnesota in the 1960s. Can you talk about the anti-Semitism that he faced and how it shaped his career?
Yeah. Well, as it goes to the Twin Cities, and I'm looking in my index here to get the exact date, there was a famous article called Minneapolis, the Curious Twin, which was written by Kerry McWilliams, the commentator of those days. And that was written in 1946. And in 1946, McWilliams exposed the anti-Semitism in Minneapolis, not in St. Paul, but mostly in the city of Minneapolis. These are times when Jews couldn't buy homes in certain areas, when the AAA, the American Automobile Association, wouldn't allow Jews to join the AAA here in Minneapolis, even though the president of AAA in St. Paul was Jewish. Minneapolis was really known as a, you know, hotbed, coldbed of anti-Semitism, while St. Paul was more diverse, more Catholic, and just more open to differences. So when High was looking to get a job and then finally landed one here in Minnesota, his friends and mentors in New York, including John Hope Franklin, said to him and others, you are walking into an anti-Semitic minefield, not only in that community, but at the University of Minnesota, which had very few Jewish historians on the faculty. I was very sensitive. His radar, his antennae, I guess you would say, were all around that, because having grown up in New York, although he grew up in this Jewish milieu, he was aware of anti-Semitism, of course, and then his disillusionment with the Soviet Union had really focused him on the fact that entire societies can be anti-Semitic to the extent where people are being killed. And then, of course, World War II occurred, and he was just super sensitive to that. So once he gets here, though, he's in a period of time where the University of Minnesota is beginning to break down some of the barriers to the faculty. But he becomes interested in the election that I mentioned that Harold Stassen wins, which is the 1938 gubernatorial election. And he writes about that in a quite a scholarly piece. And then he also writes a pamphlet about the history of Judaism and Jews here in the state. And he becomes sort of the Jewish scholar here in Minnesota, which does not have a large Jewish community, but the Twin Cities has a sizable one, and one that is influential here in the Twin Cities now. And it's broken down, I would say, so that we're certainly not as anti-Semitic as we were in the 40s. So, you know, growing up Jewish in America in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, throughout the war years, my parents were of his age and of that period of time. Anti-Semitism was a reality, and people had to, work through it and achieve what they did in spite of it. And part of his scholarship and part of his public history was always being mindful of the fact of discrimination in general, which is why he was so committed to this multiculturalism on campus as well.
Yeah, definitely. I got the feeling that he's sort of ahead of his time in his way of thinking. Would you agree with that?
I think so. You know, we haven't even gotten to this point, but I mean, his major academic focus was labor history. And he was not a pioneer, but he was among the first wave of young historians who focused on working people. As he wrote later, you know, seeing history through the eyes of the vanquished and not the victor. And so that his DNA was this immigrant kid of working parents. So working class parents. So he was interested in the history of the clothing workers unions, the struggles of the strikes, the trucker strikes of 1934, I think it was, and some others. His PhD was about clothing workers. So he was a labor historian. So, sort of the common person. And then when the 1960s came, and there was revolution with a small r for women and people of color, it plugged right into Hyde's sensibilities and also his support for students in general. And in some ways, I think his real love for the University of Minnesota, he was a tremendous citizen of the university, as left wing as he was, and as much of a dissident as he was on many things, he was a real advocate for the U. And in that advocacy, I think that he saw that students wanted and the university needed the kinds of multicultural programs that he supported, and he supported what he called the free university, where there were classes that would be extremely non-traditional. He thought that that was the way that, you know, that things should go. So he was ahead of his time, but he was, it's on the same thread of his life. You know, you asked about putting it into historic context. I think that if you follow Hi Berman's life along the line from his birth in 1925 until his death in 2015, you see that he was just part of the dominant trends of that period, with the exception maybe of the mid-50s to the early 60s, a 5 to 7 year period, where he was really committed to just getting a darn job, having his kids born, making sure his spouse was happy, the things that we all do when we're in our kind of 30s. But then once he landed here, he really began to flourish and to commit himself to a career that made a mark.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a little bit more about landing here. He was teaching in Michigan very briefly before he was offered the position at the U. And then thereafter, I think he said he had offered a position in California. And then, of course, he traveled a lot thereafter. Why did he choose Minnesota and why did he choose to stay?
Well, he chose Minnesota because he didn't like Michigan. he chose Minnesota because David Noble, who was another great historian, a cultural historian here at the university, had befriended him at academic conferences, and Noble recruited him here. And the story that he tells in the book is that after having been in New York his entire life, along with his wife, Betty, he got this great job offer to Michigan State, finally, at a large research university that would probably have tenure track possibilities. But they were quite cultural in New York. They went to opera, they went to jazz, they went to art museums, they had a great apartment. And Betty in particular was not enamored with East Lansing, which at that point she viewed and High viewed as kind of a Cal school, COW. They lived near the football stadium. People got rowdy on weekends, and there were no sidewalks where they lived. So when High was invited here for a guest lecture, and he had no idea that it was really a recruiting trip, it soon turned into an offer to jump to Minnesota just 6 months or so after he had gotten the job at Michigan State. He called Betty and told her about this job offer, and she asked one question, and that was, are there sidewalks in Minnesota? High said, there are sidewalks. She said, take the job. So that's how he got here. His stint at Berkeley was a visiting stint, and yes, he could have stayed, or so he says, but he had been established here. He had a great gig here. He was already an activist, you know, an active member of the community. He had access to the presidents of the university. He became, within a 5 or 6 year period, a remarkable historian of the state itself, and almost encyclopedic about some key historic moments here in the state, particularly around labor history and Jewish history, Iron Range history, which is, you know, the northern part of the state. So he really began to develop a life here, and by that point, his children were in school. He also had another job offer, and I actually am forgetting if we've written this, at one point to go back to New York to be the head of, I believe it was the Jewish Historical Association or some pretty prominent New York.
Yes. Yeah, you did write about that, or he did.
Think tank. And he turned that down. And I've seen some of the letters there. We don't go into it in much. He would have gotten a pretty sizable raise in those days, but he just decided to stay here in academia. So why did he stay? Like a lot of us do, he had a great job. He was well respected. His family had settled in. They had a beautiful house about a block from the Mississippi River in South Minneapolis. And he just had a great career here.
So a lot of the book just details High's life. It doesn't really get into too much about his perspectives as a historian until later in the book. And there's one thing that I would like to read that I just found remarkable. It was almost moving how eloquent it was. So if you just bear with me for a moment, I'd like to read a quote from the book.
Sure.
"We may see Indians driven from their homes and told by a chorus of well-meaning voices that nowhere in the future is there a place for their holy beliefs and cherished customs, that to survive they must deny their identity and become white men. We may see immigrants torn between hope for the new world and homesickness for the old, watching their children slowly weaned from the old ways and the old language to become foreigners under their very roofs. We will see towns dead or dying along with hopes that built them when the railroad located elsewhere. We will see farmers driven under by drought or debt or grasshoppers packing up their very few belongings and sadly moving on. We will see game destroyed, forests leveled, hillsides eroded, and streams polluted by careless greed. And inevitably, the question will arise, what have we now, and is it worth the cost?" I just thought that was incredibly profound. When did he utter that, or what do you think of that?
Well, I'm looking to see where we have that included in it, and I'm guessing, it's towards the end, and I believe that he said this. Is this in the chapter of the Perpich speech, or is this? And can you tell me what page you're on?
Sure. It is page 150 in the conclusion, History Through the Eyes of the Vanquished.
Okay, so now, exactly. So this is, in High's view, not only is it a speech about history, but it's a historic speech. Rudy Perpich was the governor. High was in his kitchen cabinet. High had met Rudy in about 1961-62 in the first big project that he did at the university, which was to go up to the Iron Range in Minnesota and to immerse himself in the immigrant experience. They went on to become friends and colleagues, and then Perpich asked him to be his almost unofficial chief of staff. And High encouraged Rudy Perpich to give a speech about history and the importance of history. Perpich agreed to it. And even though Perpich delivered the speech, High wrote the speech. And those words, while uttered by Perpich, were really from High's heart. But he and Rudy had very similar backgrounds in the fact that Perpich was the son of immigrants, working class immigrants. His father, Anton, like High's father, David, was affiliated with the Communist Party. And those words that you read, they speak to and they plug into what we've been talking about before. That is, High's understanding, his sensibilities, his affection for understanding what the other feels like, whether they be American Indians or immigrants or working people. And those words are about as, and I'm glad you pointed them out, are about as well written as High wrote. And so, because he really felt it. He was not a great writer in his academic stuff. And there's some things that he wrote that were so didactic and academic. I think he was just trying to prove that he was one of the club sometimes. But I'm glad that you were moved by it. I think that entire speech, which we reprint almost in full, I did it to take some stuff out, is a highlight. There's another part of the book where High talks about teaching, and that's part of an interview he gave in 1992 on public TV here, and his belief that he was there to teach critical thinking more than the facts of history. Those are, to me, the highlight lessons that we offer it in the book. So, you know, so thanks for reading that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think he mentions that he's critical of online learning, which is becoming more and more prevalent. And he had mentioned something about human interaction being necessary to teach and to learn.
Yeah. And he was a strong a believer in that. And his academic hero was a guy named Salo Baron, professor at Columbia, perhaps best known for being the historian who testified at the war crimes trial against Adolf Eichmann in Israel after World War II. And when Hai first saw Baron give a lecture, the man used no notes at all. This is a guy, Salo Baron, who wrote a 19-volume history of the Jewish people, and it only got up to the year 1650. So this was a detail-oriented person. But the other thing that Baron did was bring students over to his house to have dinner and expound on the lectures that he gave. And so I was a high touch kind of professor, even as he used electronics like TV and radio to translate history for, you know, for everyone else.
Well, there are so many stories in this that I think we could go on forever, but I think we'll have to let readers page through it themselves. But before we end, and certainly I think you've proven this already, but your subtitle, The Last Lecture of Minnesota's Greatest Public Historian, why do you say he's Minnesota's greatest public historian?
Because there's been no one else in recent memory who has played the role of talking to the public about the role of history, the background that current events has against that history, than Hai Berman. On the Almanac TV show, which is among the highest rated public TV shows, local public TV shows in the country, he was a guest more than anyone else, about 100 times on public radio, on TV, and on the commercial channels. I was there on election nights, and he didn't just talk about the results of the election. He would say, do you remember in 1944? Do you remember that the 1948 convention had this? And he was always placing current events in context. You know, we have had, and we have today, some local pundits, I would say, political science pundits, who try to put into political perspective some events that are happening. But we don't have anyone who brings the historical background that Hai did. And of course, some of that had to do with the fact that he lived for such a long time as well. And we also say it because we believe it. We believe that he was Minnesota's greatest public historian. And so far, no one's disputed it. So it's my story, and we're sticking to it.
Okay. Well, I'm definitely convinced after reading the book. So, what are you working on now?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. I've been there for a couple of years, and I'm going to be retiring, or deinstitutionalizing, as I call it, towards the middle of this year. And I've got a couple other book projects that I'm working on, and when they come out, I'll let you know. One is a little bit of a memoir of some experiences that I've had. Another one is a children's book that I would like to do. I've got some other books in the works, and I look forward to having the time to do all that.
Well, excellent. Congratulations on your upcoming retirement, and I'll look forward to those projects.
Great. Well, I really appreciate you having me on this to talk about Hai Berman and our book.
Of course. Where can listeners get a copy of the book?
Well, they're in all the bookstores, certainly in the Twin Cities. They're on Amazon. University of Minnesota Press has it on their website, Professor Berman, The Last Lecture of Minnesota's Greatest Public Historian. You know, I've done book events throughout the Twin Cities at a couple bookstores. Pretty much every bookstore in town has it. Certainly the campus bookstore has it as well at the University of Minnesota.
Great. I've been talking with Jay Wiener, co-author of the book Professor Berman, The Last Lecture of Minnesota's Greatest Public Historian. Jay, thank you so much.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.